Welcome to TWiL, the Week in Health Law, the podcast of record for the discussion of health law and policy. We're recording this episode on May the 12th, 2015. I'm Nicholas Terry, a law professor at Indiana University McKinney School of Law in Indianapolis. My co-host is...
Frank Pasquale, a law professor at the University of Maryland School of Law in Baltimore, Maryland.
Today, a special treat. We are joined for our very first return guest. Nicole Huberfeld is the H. Wendell Cherry Professor of Law at the University of Kentucky College of Law and a bioethics associate at the College of Medicine there. As many of you already know, Nicole is an expert on the intersection of constitutional law and federal healthcare programs. Welcome, Nikki.
Glad to be back. Thank you very much.
So the subtitle of this show is, quote, "There's more to life and healthcare federalism than King and Burwell." That subsidy case is just now beginning to percolate back into the press view ahead of what we can only assume is a Supreme Court decision coming up within, what, 3-4 weeks. But there's lots more to talk about, and some of it actually may be more important than we see from King and Burwell, particularly if the government is upheld in that case. So here's a partial list of some of the things that have been happening in healthcare federalism over the last couple of months. There's the St. Louis Effort for AIDS case, the Affordable Care Act Navigators case. We've got a case on the private right of action under the Medicaid statute. And, of course, there's the pantomime that's playing out in Florida, where Governor Scott is trying to plug his huge budget hole by alternately negotiating with and suing the federal government. So, Nicole, where would you like to start?
Well, it seems to me that we can start with the Eighth Circuit case, if you don't mind, St. Louis Effort for AIDS versus Huff. Okay, so this case is essentially a nullification is no good case, if I can put it in one sentence. So what's happening here is that, as our listeners are probably aware, under the Affordable Care Act, there are people who are functioning as what are called navigators. The role of navigators is to assist consumers in their purchase of private insurance in the health insurance exchanges, whether they be federally based or state based. And there have been some subcategories created that are sort of similar to navigators. They're certified application counselors and also non-navigator assisters. And all of these people assist consumers with enrollment in health insurance in the exchanges. And so one thing that's happened is that throughout the states, there has been efforts at deciding where navigators and what are called CACs, the certified application counselors, and non-navigator assisters fit within traditional schemes that include people like insurance agents and insurance brokers who, as I'm sure you're aware, historically are often licensed by the state, especially brokers, because states are responsible for the regulation of insurance. And so the ACA has this very vague preemption language that basically says that state laws can continue to exist so long as they don't get in the way of the implementation of the ACA. And I'm obviously paraphrasing there, but it's just about that vague. And so some states have created laws trying to kind of neatly fit navigators and CACs into their insurance broker licensure schemes. But some states have created legislation that is hostile to the exchanges, hostile to navigators, hostile to CACs, and non-navigator assisters. And so Missouri is one of the states that created legislation that was, in some sense, trying to figure out where these folks would fit in their brokerage scheme, but also imposing restrictions on them that effectively made it so that they could not offer advice to people seeking to buy insurance on the exchanges. And so in this particular case, St. Louis Effort for AIDS versus Huff, there was a set of CACs who were challenging this Missouri legislation. And so this case at the district court level resulted in an injunction against the statute writ large. It was a rather wide-reaching injunction. The Eighth Circuit upheld the district court in part But there was a standing problem because no navigators were actually involved in the case. And so the court said, to the extent that there are no navigators acting as plaintiffs in this case, we really can't respond to the concerns about how navigators are affected by this legislation. However, we do think that the CAC's argument is correct, that the ACA preempts the major provisions of this Missouri legislation that prevent the CACs from offering advice to the citizens of Missouri so that they can sign up for health insurance in the exchanges. And so the reason I say that this is basically you can't nullify federal law is that is what states have been trying to do ever since the ACA was enacted. States have been writing all kinds of laws, enacting all kinds of laws that basically say we don't think this should be the policy in our state. Well, it's federal law. You don't get to just negate it by saying you don't like it. And so in some ways, the Eighth Circuit is saying we believe that this law is the law of the land. So that's what's happening in that case.
Let's assume that we are not a state that is basically trying to chill the ACA with a statute like this, but one that is genuinely trying to ensure quality in sort of insurance advising. Is that route left open for states to still do that after this case?
It is. And in fact, the regulations that HHS wrote implementing the ACA's provisions regarding navigators do leave room for the states to regulate navigators in a fashion that's complementary to the job that they're supposed to do under the ACA. And I know I'm switching back and forth between navigators and CACs. I mean, they functionally do, I think, kind of the same thing. But the Eighth Circuit was careful to separate them out for standing purposes. So the short answer is yes, states do have some room to regulate, but they can't do it in such a way that it will be a burden or a hurdle to navigators and CACs performing their jobs to enroll people in insurance.
So Tim Jost, in a piece on the Health Affairs blog, noted that the Eighth Circuit decision, there were three judges, two G.W. Bush appointees and the third a Reagan appointee. And so even politics can be overcome by really silly behavior by states. So on then, if we may, to the Armstrong case, the private right of action case. This one, I think, is certainly for a non-healthcare financing person like me, this seems very complicated. The gentlest of all glide paths for me, if you could manage that, Nikki.
I will do my best. It is complicated. Even for people who think about this stuff, it's complicated. And so we need to sort of take this piece by piece, if I may. So under the Medicaid Act, there are certain mandatory elements that states must abide by. And one of those mandatory elements is a provision that's commonly referred to as either 30A or equal access. And that provision tells states that they must pay sufficiently to ensure equal access to healthcare for Medicaid enrollees in the geographic region in which they reside. So it's not that a state has to ensure that a person living in rural Kentucky has the same access to healthcare as a person living in the center of New York City, but that a person living in rural Kentucky has the same access to healthcare as another person living in rural Kentucky who's not a Medicaid beneficiary. And so, as you might imagine, the term sufficient payment has been the source of a lot of angst over time. And litigation over the equal access provision is almost as old as the Medicaid Act itself. When Medicaid was enacted in 1965, healthcare providers were basically paid their reasonable costs of care. In 1980, the Act was amended to create the Bourne Amendment. The Bourne Amendment made it so that states had a little bit more wiggle room, that they didn't necessarily have to pay the reasonable costs of care, and instead they had to pay reasonably and adequately. Well, that, as you might imagine, resulted in the states reducing how much they were paying healthcare providers. And so healthcare providers started to sue states for fair payment, basically. The route that they took to do that was Section 1983. Section 1983 is a civil rights statute that makes it so that plaintiffs can hail states into federal court seeking enforcement of federal rights. And so right around the same time that the Bourne Amendment was created, the Supreme Court also decided Maine versus Thibodeau, which was a case that made it clear that Section 1983 could be used to enforce any civil rights, excuse me, any rights under federal statutes, not just civil rights under federal statutes. Now, as you may be aware, Maine versus Thibodeau is probably the high point of Section 1983 litigation in terms of inviting plaintiffs to use Section 1983 to get into federal court when states are doing them wrong. Not that long after that, Section 1983 litigation was narrowed by Blessing versus Freestone, and then narrowed again by Gonzaga University versus Doe in 2002. And so the reason that I discuss that is that the narrowing of Section 1983 doctrine made it so that it was harder for plaintiffs, Medicaid providers, Medicaid beneficiaries, to hail states into federal court when they were claiming violations of the equal access provision. And so, particularly after Gonzaga, lower federal courts have held that although there are other aspects of the Medicaid Act that are still enforceable through Section 1983, lower federal courts pretty consistently said that 30A, the equal access provision, was not enforceable through Section 1983. So Medicaid providers and beneficiaries got a little bit creative and started to hail states into federal court under a supremacy clause theory, under which they were claiming the Medicaid Act requires that you pay us sufficiently. You're not paying us sufficiently. Therefore, you're violating federal law. We're seeking an injunction to prevent you from violating federal law. So they can't seek damages. All they can seek is an injunction under the supremacy clause, just like anyone else claiming preemption, basically. So in 2012, the Supreme Court decided a case called Douglas versus Independent Living Center. That case is the case in which the Supreme Court first considered the question of whether Medicaid providers, in particular, could use the Supremacy Clause as a kind of workaround against the shutting down of Section 1983 equal access claims. And so, interestingly, in Douglas, Justice Breyer wrote a majority opinion in which he allowed HHS to exercise primary jurisdiction, meaning that he said HHS hasn't weighed in on the rate changes yet at issue in this particular case. We think that HHS should weigh in first. But Chief Justice Roberts wrote a dissent in Douglas, rallying the conservative justices and describing that they thought that the Supremacy Clause was not available for Medicaid providers to get into court to prevent states from violating the Medicaid Act, at least with regard to Section 30A, the Equal Access Provision. 3 years later, we're back in court, same issue. So Armstrong versus Exceptional Child Center is a case that looks very much like Douglas, same kind of question: can the Supremacy Clause be used as an avenue for Medicaid providers to force states to pay fairly when they are not paying fairly? And in fact, in this case, interestingly, Idaho had passed a statute that required its state Medicaid agency to study rehabilitation services and ensure that those providers offering rehabilitation services were being paid fairly, were receiving the cost of their care. The legislature then failed to allocate the funding for that increase in payment, and so the providers sued. It seemed like it should be an open and shut case. The district court held for the providers, the Ninth Circuit held for the providers, but Idaho sought a petition for certiorari. It was granted, and they brought the Supremacy Clause question back to the Supreme Court. And so here, in an opinion written by Justice Scalia, the Supreme Court shut down Supremacy Clause actions for Medicaid providers seeking to prevent states from violating the equal access provision. Now, it's an interesting set of opinions in this case because Justice Scalia wrote for a majority that included Justice Breyer, but Justice Breyer wrote a concurring opinion in which he separated himself out from some concluding language in the majority's opinion that would have taken this a step farther and said, if we're talking about any spending clause legislation, Supremacy Clause actions are not available because the Supremacy Clause loans itself to this contract analogy that we've seen in other cases. The court says this is like a contract between the federal government and the states. Beneficiaries of these programs don't have any rights in these programs to enforce any aspect of that contract between the federal government and the state, unless Congress makes it clear that it intended to allow private rights of action. So the thing about the Medicaid Act is that it doesn't say anything one way or another about private rights of action. And in fact, it only allows an action for someone who is denied benefits when they meet the eligibility rules for getting into Medicaid. That's it. That's all that's addressed. So the majority said, well, HHS has the ability to withdraw funds. We think that that ought to be the way that this is handled. This is a negotiation between the federal agency and the state. It's a complex regulatory scheme, and we think that it should stay between the federal agency and the state. Breyer agreed with that. As you know, he's a former administrative law professor. He thinks deeply about administrative law questions, and he agreed that given the complexity of the regulatory scheme, it was best left to HHS and the state to negotiate what equal access would mean. There are several problems with that, though. One of them is that HHS itself has said that it relies on private rights of action to flag bad state behavior because it doesn't have enough people or money or other power to actually police what's happening in the states, particularly when it comes to questions of payment rates, because they're so granular. It's so in the weeds. And so there's this wonderful amicus brief filed on behalf of former administrators of HHS written by Steve Vladek at American. And the brief basically says, we need these private rights of action. And it's remarkable because the Solicitor General, acting on behalf of the Obama administration, actually advocated to shut down these rights of action. So there's a lot of sort of behind-the-scenes politics going on here. The client agency isn't represented by the Solicitor General. There's a separate amicus brief representing their point of view. And weirdly, Justice Breyer was not swayed by the former administrators of HHS saying that they need these private rights of action. The dissent, on the other hand, authored by Justice Sotomayor, basically read that brief and was convinced by it and took it up. And so that's what's going on in Armstrong.
Well, I have to say, Nikki, that was a real tour de force of explanation of certainly one of the most complex cases on the Supreme Court dockets this year, on its docket this year. And it was such a rich response. I have many follow-ups I'd like to ask, but perhaps given that you just mentioned Vladek's amicus brief, one of the items that I was used to prepare for the show today was a post he had done at Prof's blog, and looking at that post and then also a response from Marty Letterman, who I think is a little more sympathetic to the majority opinion. And I'm going to ask a naive question because, you know, con law is not my area of expertise, but I think that there might be a lot of listeners that will sort of, I think, be edified or be interested in as I will be by your response to this somewhat naive question, but just building on Justice Scalia's argument here, where he states, quote, the sole remedy Congress provided for a state's failure to comply with Medicaid's requirements is the withholding of Medicaid funds by the Secretary of Health and Human Services. You know, it appears there that essentially what the majority in Armstrong is trying to do is to say, look, HHS, you're the ones with ultimate responsibility, and if you are dissatisfied with the way a state is running a program, go for the brinksmanship. Just tell them, you know, within, say, 6 months or a year, no more funding whatsoever, and that'll be the end of your Medicaid program, or at least of the federal funding of it, and that will get them into line. And yet it seems simultaneously, though, that in NFIB versus Sebelius, if that majority opinion with respect to federalism and healthcare is to mean anything, it's to caution the federal government against that type of brinksmanship and coercion. I guess perhaps the idea is that this coercion was already part of the bargain before. I don't know. But any response to that tension that I'm seeing?
I have at least 3 to 5 responses, and I'll try to limit myself. So your point is well taken. I mean, Justice Scalia certainly argued that the legislation in Section 1396C allows HHS the authority to withdraw funding. This was, as you said, at issue in NFIB. And so this is, I think, an important point for a number of reasons. The first is, I'll mention that Justice Scalia's interpretation of the Medicaid Act is flat out wrong. He reads Section 1936C and then says, and so therefore, there's no private right of action allowed. Congress doesn't want one. Well, I actually don't think that's right. And here's why. Congress considered preventing private rights of action when it eliminated the Boren Amendment and replaced it with what is now the Equal Access Provision. At that time, when it considered preventing private rights of action, that movement failed. Congress has never prevented private rights of action in the Medicaid Act. And in fact, in Douglas, there was a brief by members of Congress stating such. And so the history of the Medicaid Act actually shows us differently than what Scalia's interpretation was. So it's simply not true that Congress intended to prevent other rights of action. It's simply that it gave the enabled agency the power to respond to failures, but it wasn't the only intended response. And it seems like for years, Congress has known there are these private rights of action and has allowed them to exist. So that's one way to think about that. Another way to think about it is that this is a real conundrum that Scalia has set up for HHS, because, as you mentioned, in NFIB versus Sibelius, it was Section 1396C that led the court, Chief Justice Roberts in his plurality and the joint dissent in agreement, to believe that coercion was possible because HHS has the ability to withdraw all of a state's funding if that state's not complying with the Medicaid Act. And so it's a little bit of a damned if you do, damned if you don't moment for HHS. It's further complicated by the fact that, for reasons that remain unclear, HHS drafted regulations that were supposed to sort of fill in what equal access means, what sufficient payment means, back in 2011, and they have never been finalized. My personal theory about that is that HHS has been so distracted negotiating all of the Medicaid expansion waivers that it really hasn't had time to circle back around on sufficient payment. That's become sort of a secondary or tertiary issue relative to the primary issue of expansion. But that's just my personal theory, and I don't know if there's anything to it. So that was part of the dynamic in Douglas, and the court being interested in holding off was that everybody was sort of waiting for those regulations to come out. Well, they still haven't come out. Is that an abrogation of HHS's responsibility? I think so, but nobody really knows what's happening with that. I would also say there is some danger here in terms of what the court is saying HHS ought to do. So we know that HHS has never withheld all of a state's funding when a state has failed to comply with the Medicaid Act because it would be harmful to beneficiaries. And it's not really the state that would suffer so much as the beneficiaries who need Medicaid funding to ensure their access to care. And so one of the things that makes sufficient payment so important in this moment is the Medicaid expansion, because we had for 2 years an increase in payments to primary care providers in Medicaid to 100% of Medicare levels. And some recent economic studies have shown that even just that two-year bump seems to have made physicians who treat Medicaid patients more willing to see more Medicaid patients. It's a little bit unclear whether physicians who were not treating Medicaid patients were willing to suddenly see Medicaid patients. That is, I think, the jury's still out on. But with regard to those physicians who were already seeing Medicaid patients, they were willing to see more of them, and they didn't delay their appointments. So in other words, instead of dropping Medicaid patients and seeing Medicare or private pay patients, there was a greater willingness to see Medicaid patients. And that really matters in this moment of expansion with millions of people getting onto the Medicaid rolls. So like all of my answers, it's complicated.
If you were to look sort of 5 years down the line, you know, as a health law casebook editor, is Armstrong going to be a small footnote in the section dealing with the Medicaid statute? Or is it going to be a lead case followed by a large number of notes detailing intended and unintended consequences of this decision?
That's a great question. I think in the short term, it's a lead case, because for now, it really matters that providers cannot bring 30A actions anymore. Now, of course, the administrative processes are still available. If providers decide to pursue state failures with HHS and HHS doesn't respond as it ought to, of course, there's the APA, and ultimately the APA does get you back into federal court, but that's a much longer process. I think for now, it really matters. And the reason that I'm hedging a little bit is that it really depends on what HHS ultimately does with its own sufficient payment regulations. The regulations that it drafted 4 years ago were, I would say, barely adequate in that they forced states to perform surveys to understand what their changes in payment rates do. But there's no hard line, at least as the regulations were drafted, that indicates what HHS can or cannot do or will not do if a state is not paying sufficiently. So I have to punt that one just a little bit, because it really depends on whether HHS takes its own regulations and makes them meaningful.
So Nikki, that was really a great overview of so many legal issues that are coming out of this spate of litigation. I was wondering if we could transition at this point to some things that are going on in particular states. I noticed recently that Governor Scott, Rick Scott of Florida, was quoted in a newspaper essentially saying that he believed that rather than seeking certain federal funds or Medicaid expansion, the hospitals in the state should just be reallocating their profits. So the very profitable hospitals, that should just be taken and given to the less advantaged. And, you know, somewhat surprising line, given that I had thought that a lot of times the GOP or sort of the red state line was that for-profit healthcare was a very good thing, but that would seem to be quite a deterrent if we were to turn that on its head and say that profits were an indication of, I guess, gouging that would lead them to need to pay for the care of the poor in a self-cannibalization of the healthcare system. So I was just wondering if you might have any further thoughts on the struggle in Florida over budget gaps and their relationship to NFIB versus Sebelius enabling non-expansion of Medicaid in, I believe it's 20 states now, is that right?
It's a great question, Frank. Florida is really going back and forth. Governor Scott has really gone back and forth. As you know, he led the charge with this Florida being the lead plaintiff among the states who challenged the ACA in the first place. And it was that litigation, amongst all of the litigation nationwide, that raised the question of the constitutionality of Medicaid's expansion. Other litigation focused heavily on the individual mandate. It was Florida that raised the question of coercion. And so Governor Scott has sort of been on again, off again in his interest in expanding Medicaid. And I have been tracking what the states have been doing and what their politics look like at the local level to figure out which states are going to turn when. And Florida, up until a couple weeks ago, looked like it was on the track to expand its Medicaid program. Florida Senate has certainly expressed interest in some kind of waiver being negotiated with HHS. Florida's House has been a holdout. And so there has been a lot of back and forth that ultimately has resulted in perhaps some gamesmanship. I'm not quite sure what I want to call it, because as you're aware, there has been a lawsuit filed by Florida against HHS. Scott versus HHS was filed in the Northern District of Florida, which is where NFIB versus Sebelius began as Florida versus HHS back in 2011, I think. And what's going on here is that Florida has had something called a low-income poll, which about eight or so states have had historically. Most of those states, I think about five of them, have expanded Medicaid, and a couple of them have not. Florida, Kansas, Tennessee, and Texas all have low-income pools and have not expanded Medicaid under the ACA yet. And so a year ago, Florida was told by HHS, we are not going to continue your low-income pool in the form that it has existed. And at the time, Florida said, okay, and they talked about Florida working on its expansion, which Scott agreed with at the time. And the reason the low-income pool exists is that Florida obtained it by waiver back in about 2005, 2006 as a way to facilitate funding where no funding was available for people who were ineligible for Medicaid. It also facilitated Florida's switch to managed care in its Medicaid program and helped to fill some of the gaps where the managed care providers might not be paying hospitals as much as they were used to receiving from the state. So the low-income pool has existed in Florida for nearly 10 years, but they were told a year ago that their waiver that facilitated it would only exist for another year. When HHS told Florida that, it was very above board, it was very clear, it expected Florida to figure out other ways to go about facilitating caring for people who could be uninsured under the ACA, namely the Medicaid expansion population, childless adults under the age of 65 who were earning less than 133% of the federal poverty level. And so when HHS saw that Florida was not really getting its act together to expand its Medicaid program in time for that waiver to expire, it let Florida know that it was not going to renew the waiver. That seems to have really angered Governor Scott. Governor Scott filed this lawsuit against HHS claiming coercion, NFIB style. And if you read the complaint, it reads like Lucy has moved Charlie Brown's football because the state seems to come off very sort of, you know, you told us we should do this and we did this and we didn't know that this would be the result and now you're coercing us. And they're trying to force HHS to maintain a waiver. This is the first such lawsuit of its type that I'm aware of. I am not aware of any other state ever trying to force HHS to continue a waiver. And for good reason. Section 1115 of the Social Security Act gives HHS absolute discretion in granting waivers so long as the waiver furthers the purposes of the Medicaid program. Well, Florida's low-income pool waiver no longer furthers the purposes of the Medicaid program because the Medicaid program now includes the option to expand eligibility to childless adults. And if Florida were to expand, it would, according to an Urban Institute study, reduce the amount of funding necessary, if by necessary we're measuring the amount of money in the low-income pool, it would reduce that low-income pool funding by about two-thirds. In other words, it would be covered by Medicaid and other mechanisms. So the state is claiming coercion because HHS will not continue a waiver when HHS has absolute discretion to grant waivers in the first place. So I think their claim is pie in the sky for that reason alone. It is also absurd, if I can use a strong word, because this isn't coercion. This isn't, to the extent that we have any understanding of what coercion doctrine is from NFIB versus Sebelius, as I've written about, the doctrine is rather fuzzy based on NFIB versus Sebelius. There has to be some kind of link between a statutory requirement and the threat to remove funding. Well, the low-income pool is not a statutory requirement. It is an agreement that the state and HHS came to years ago to facilitate managed care. Well, that transition is done. And so based on the original understanding of what the low-income pool existed for, there's no more reason to continue it. There's no reason for Florida to have this special deal that facilitates payment for charity care. So in my view, HHS is right not to continue the low-income pool. But all of that being said, we have seen that the courts are open to allowing the velociraptors to test the fence. That's as I've been saying all along, the states are interested in exploring this coercion theory, and they're going to do it. And I think, you know, there may be some value in allowing that to occur so that we all understand it better, but I would be surprised if this goes anywhere.
So there are another couple of states, I think, that are similarly situated to Florida and are kind of waiting to see how things turn out there. But just in the last just few seconds that we have together, Nicole, is there any better news that you can report from the war zone over the ACA and the attempts to get Medicaid expansion into more states?
Well, the good news is that Montana has passed legislation to expand Medicaid to its childless adults who were non-elderly. That legislation does require a waiver, and so Montana will now negotiate a waiver with HHS, and so that's a positive step. There are some states that are still in play in this legislative session, so Alaska is still in play. Arguably, Utah is still in play. Utah has been in active talks with HHS over its version of a waiver. It sounds like Missouri may still be in play. And so in this particular legislative session, I think that we'll see that there may still be some movement. A couple of these state legislatures are going to have to call special sessions to make that happen, but I do think it will happen. And so then the next question is, how do these states that are going to seek waivers going forward build on the most recent notable waiver, which is Indiana's waiver? And that waiver has all kinds of elements like cost sharing and some other proposals that HHS accepted that are sort of allowing so-called red state legislatures and governors to find more conservatively friendly mechanisms for expanding Medicaid.
That was this week's The Week in Health Law. A really special thank you to Nicole Huberfeld, who did all the work today. Nicole, thanks so much for joining us again.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a great pleasure.
We post our show notes at twill.com. That's TWIHL.com. You can contact me at Nicholas Terry on Twitter. And Frank, where can you be found?
I'm at Frank Pasquale on Twitter.
Thank you for joining us, and have a legally interesting but healthy week.